Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, a nonprofit living laboratory for accomplishing social change. It is my privilege to host this podcast where we talk with change leaders from around the world about our human potential for creating more healthy and humane places to live. I'm so pleased to welcome Christy McGill as my guest on Making Change. After a career teaching special education to kids with severe disabilities and a second career as the mom of three kids, Christy has spent the past 12 years as the executive director of the Healthy Communities Coalition of Lyon and Story Counties in rural northern Nevada, a collaboration of local residents and groups who work together to develop and implement strategies to make their region a healthier place to live. Whether they're helping community groups find and share resources, collecting and distributing data and creating awareness of community issues, or working on collaborative fundraising, Christy and the Healthy Communities Coalition exemplify what it means to mobilize citizens to create outcomes, to bring out the best in each other and in their communities. Given the breadth of experience and wisdom she brings, not only to rural Nevada, but to the field of social change overall, it is my pleasure to have Christy McGill share her observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Christy McGill. Welcome, Christy.
Thank you.
It is just a pleasure to have you here. I'm a huge fan of the work that you're doing. And I'm hoping that you could start out by just sharing with our listeners a little bit about the winding path that led you to the work that you're doing right now.
It was definitely a winding path. I started as a special education teacher and then got pregnant with three beautiful children and wanted more flexibility, so decided to apply for a job that was management of a coalition, and I didn't even know what a coalition was. I looked it up in the dictionary and applied, and that was 12 years ago, and from there, it's just been a winding but beautiful journey. One of the key factors that I'm so excited about my job is that I get to meet amazing people along the way. I've had so many mentors that I just feel so gracious about. Basically, that's it. It's a simple story. The key has been the amazing people I've been able to work with along the way.
It is not an unusual story in rural communities. So often in the change world, we talk with folks in urban areas and all the urban issues. And so I'm really excited to learn more about the work that you're doing, which leads me to ask the question that I start all of these interviews with. When you see change happening, and I know that you have seen tremendous change happening in the areas that you guys serve, what do you see underpinning that change?
It's a great question. And it feels like I've thought about it for years. And it's really exciting to talk about it because it's not something you bring up at parties. You know, it's really kind of excited to be able to actually talk about. So what I thought I would do is start at the larger level of planning and then dial back into inclusion and end with what I really see as the causal factor of change, which is acceptance and love. So on the bigger picture of planning, just some things that we learned right here in rural Nevada is that we get a little scared when we start to hear people say, we're going to plan for 5 to 10 years and it's going to take us 12 months. And the reason we get a little scared with that is because it's kind of like someone coming out on a first date and saying, I've got the next 5 years planned for you guys. It's like, oh gosh, what about relational? I don't know you. So we kind of get scared with large planning. Not to say that planning is not important. It is important, but those little red flags happen, especially when we work with governments that say they want to make a statewide plan or that they're going to target a certain population. It starts to get that red flag because really what we've learned here is that community change is quite simply personal change. And so the further you pull that strategic plan back from that personal change is when the strategic plan starts to get a little off target. I just wanted to give you a quick example about that. Our state, our lovely state, and it was really well-intentioned, wanted to do some planning around a specific strategy. And we were a little hesitant. And they said, don't be hesitant, don't be hesitant. Well, we went through the planning process. It was lovely. They talked to us about it. They asked us what the strengths were. And we told them we really want to build on strengths. And they actually got it.
Wow.
they created a beautiful statewide plan, but then they have to go out for an RFA process to fund the plan.
And RFA is?
A request for application. And so they went out, and then, again, best intentioned. But what ended up happening is that they funded another entity from outside of our area to come in to do the very same thing the people were doing here. Mm. And so even though we spent all this time, the main factor that we stress is to build on local strengths was lost. And it wasn't lost because they were mean or boring of that. It was lost because it got caught up in that bureaucracy period of it. And so that's just an example of how complex planning can be. So what we really want to stress is that the planning really should include the people that you want to change. After doing this for 12 years, it doesn't really feel good when someone comes into our rural area and says, your indicators are terrible around poverty and substance abuse, and we need to change you. It's
like, you live in a horrible place. You didn't know you lived in a horrible place, but you're living in a horrible place.
You live in a horrible place, and let's get you changed. Again, if we go back to that, community change is personal change. And so we would never say that to somebody personally. But yet we do that when we talk about community change.
So you're not just talking about planning and then inclusion. You're talking about inclusion as part of the planning.
It has to be. Absolutely has to be. I'm going to give you a little local example. It just happened. We were talking last week at our coalition meeting about our food system. About 63 people, and we're having a lively conversation, and we were just kind of doing a gut check. Is what we're doing tied to our vision? And so one person gets up and says, part of the problem with our food system nowadays is that nobody knows how to cook. They don't know how to cook. And so everyone starts agreeing, that's right, you know, cooking is a lost art. They don't know how to cook. And so I'm sitting there and I said, well, who's they? Really, they're such good sports because they've been through this journey, and they kind of giggle. And they said, oh, that would be us. I said, okay, so do we not know how to cook in this room? And they started kind of giggling, and they said, no, most of them felt like they knew how to cook. I said, okay, so do we all make dinners for our kids and healthy meals? And they said, no. And then we kind of talked kind of kiddingly about it. Well, what is it? And someone said, you know what? I'm tired. I am tired when I come home. I work in the jail. My wife is a nurse that works outside in the hospital. So I have to do the cooking, and I'm tired when I come home. And so that's why I put in a pizza in the oven instead of cooking a healthy meal. And everyone in the room got real quiet, and they said, yeah, we're all tired. The end result is, if we would have went along with the assumption that nobody knew how to cook, and that's a popular assumption now, we would have probably said, okay, let's get some cooking classes and all that kind of stuff. But now, if we really were honest with each other, we did know how to cook. We're tired. We don't have a lot of time, and that's part of the complexity of the food system issue about the kids not getting the proper nutrition. And so our strategy started to look much differently when we started going down that road, instead of going down the road of the assumption nobody knows how to cook anymore.
It's so interesting because so many of the food security programs are all centered around nutrition education, making the assumption, as you say, that people either don't know how to cook or don't know how to cook nutritious food, or et cetera. And you're right. Sometimes it is just easier to get home, put your feet up and say, oh, I survived another day.
Yep. So that's just a really hands-on example about, in the planning process, it is relationship. It is being able to have everybody in the room.
Could you talk a little bit about the area that you guys are working in? Describe that area to us. What life is like there?
Sure. It's Lyon County in Nevada. And like many other places in the nation, during the good days, we were booming. In fact, we were one of the fastest growing counties in the nation, in the United States. We had a huge construction boom. Our county straddles the Reno-Tahoe area that was going crazy with new home construction. And so a lot of the working class people were basically classed out of the housing market. And so they moved into our area. They were a part of that construction field. And so when the crash hit, it hit our area really, really hard. Most of our families were in the construction business, and so that business actually dried up and blew away. The bummer thing is that also many of us lost most of the value of our housing, so many people were stuck here. We're about an hour to 2 hours outside of the Reno, Tahoe area. And so being stuck out here, the crash was really debilitating. And so we had entire communities on workman's comp, and suddenly our food banks were full, and it really kind of brought our entire community to its knees. And it was hard. In fact, there was a couple of meetings where we looked at each other and we really didn't know if our small little municipalities were going to actually make it. They were cut by 60%. We did not have money to pave roads, to fix our sewers, some really basic stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And out of that, we really got personal with each other because we had to. We had to collaborate in order to survive. Our school district opened up their doors. They were our strongest asset we had because they actually had things, and they were actually funneling money in from the federal government that wasn't county or state-based. And so they became our pillar. We just happened to have beautiful and wonderful school district administration that allowed for that resources to be opened up. For example, they opened up their kitchens to distribute food. They put food on their school buses. They allowed farmers to come in and process their crops in the kitchen during summer and weekend hours for value-added products so that people could keep their head above waters. We kind of basically survived together.
Yeah.
And so slowly, very slowly, coming back out of the abyss, we really discovered that we rise together. And we really discovered that it was not going to work through competition or any of those things. And that working with our county, working with our school district, working with our local government and our state government, we really could rise together. And there was really no need to compete. And that's how we survived.
It's so interesting because so often I speak with people who have gone through something catastrophic. A colleague of mine lives in Christchurch, New Zealand, where they were hit with many, many both earthquakes and aftershocks over a one-year period that just devastated the community. And we saw that in Katrina. We saw that where communities were devastated in various ways. You're speaking economic devastation. And the question that's always being asked is, people come together during the crisis, and then how do they maintain that sense of togetherness after the crisis is over? You guys seem like you have maintained that. The crisis was 2008 or so. That's 6 years ago. You're starting to come out of it. I'm curious what you see at the root of you're able to maintain that.
Right. And I think it's because they have experienced that, one, they survived together and really focused on that spirit of collaboration. And I think because we're rural, we've always had to work together. We always wear different hats. Our county commissioner, well, he's also the this, and this. And the school teacher is also the crosswalk administrator, all that kind of stuff. We all have to wear those different hats. And so we are already bridging a lot between the different agencies. And then with the crisis, we bridged further, and then we discovered in this crisis that it really wasn't our county or school governments that sustained us. It was our citizens. And we learned, I think, is that how underutilized we used our citizens before the crisis. And I'm hoping that we can carry that lesson forward. Just another quick example. One of the terrible outcomes of our economic devastation is it was one coalition meeting and our sheriff stands up and he's, our very typical rural sheriff, always strong. And, he gets up and he's got tears in his eyes and he said, this is in 4 months, we've had 30 suicides in our very small community, all of them male, all of them over the age of 40. It was part of the economic devastation. And he's like, we can't go on like this. And again, like the food crisis, everyone just came together and put in suicide prevention strategies. But what we found is that our county at this point and our school district employees and our county employees and our health and human service employees were so drastically cut back that there wasn't enough hands. So we really had to turn to the churches and our community members. And so many of our community members were out of work. We brought them in and we said, hey, you know what? We're in deep trouble. And we brought them into the process and we asked them, you know what, this is your family, your friends, your neighbors. How are we going to do this? How do we make sure that this suicide bubble stops now? It doesn't migrate on into our youth population or anything like that. And so, again, that was our catalyst to really push us. And we were able to train hundreds of people in suicide prevention. People knocked on doors, handed out cards, talked to their neighbors. We asked them, hey, get to know your neighbor. Check on them. See how they're doing. People live on large parcels of land here. So sometimes their neighbor is like 1 or 2 miles down the road. But they did it. And we came out of that crisis. It wasn't Health and Human Services. It wasn't our usual helping paid network. It was our citizens. And so that taught us, my goodness, during times of when we're starting to get out of this, if we combine that effort, that citizen effort, with the efforts of our paid helping network, really, what can we do? And so that's been the catalyst for us.
You had mentioned at the onset that it was about planning, it was about inclusion, but that it was about acceptance and love. And I would love you to go into that further, because this seems like it is the perfect example of that.
Everyone learns lessons differently, and everyone probably has different experiences. But the one absolute, and there's not a whole lot of absolutes in our jobs, but the one absolute that we kind of hold on to is that really acceptance and love, not fear or shame, are the causal factors of change. And since change is personal, and that these arbitrary systems and communities don't change without personal change, that's really important. I know there's lots of strategies out there that talk about fear or to shame, especially the subsidy strategies. And we really find that fear and shame really halt people's process, because it makes you stuck. If you're fearful or if you're shameful, you can't take that next step. And that's kind of what change is all about. It's that journey. We all go through it. Sometimes it's difficult, especially the further away you get from the community, the crazier the bureaucracy appears. Mm-hmm. And if we don't include them, if we say, oh gosh, all they're going to do is drag us down or make us crawl at a sales pace because they got this bureaucracy, we're really losing out on some amazing assets, because much of our state workers, at least here in Nevada, are young, they're educated, they're so excited, and then they get into these positions. I picture these poor people like in the middle of a mangrove jungle wanting to help, and yet all these vines are around them. So on the local level, if we can reach in and just kind of like pull apart those vines and help them do what they want to do, they want to help the local communities. You know, they want to help us plan. They want to bring some of the resources in. If we allow that to happen and we say, you know, this is what we need, boy, we got friends for life.
We so often think about whether it is governments, whether it is financial institutions, whether it is, quote unquote, the business community, as if that is one thing. In the community building world, we so often think of it as we go to them for the resources that they have as an institution. And you've just personalized that. You've just said, nah, it's not an institution. It's a bunch of people. And that whole concept of reaching in and helping government workers do what they got into this to do in the first place. I can't imagine. You're really making me think here, because I really can't imagine that there's a government worker in the world that got into their job thinking, wow, I just really want to muck things up for people. And you're really just opening the door to them stepping out of that frustration.
Yeah,
it's
and again, and once you have that partnership, once they see that by collaborating with the locals, we still have our times of stress, but we communicate. It's constant communication. And so we have that push and pull. In coalition meetings, we just say that push-pull is part of this process. And it's a very natural piece. But if you don't have it and go back and you have all this side conversation at the end, that's what kind of slows people down. Never underestimate government workers, because they're wonderful. And never underestimate the people that are at the community level dealing with the struggles day to day. And together they make something really strong. We have so much in America. We have so much resources. And if we just opened them up and shared them with each other and got over this competition, it's endless what we could do. And I get tired of always hearing we need more, because we don't. Not all the time. I mean, you know, sometimes we may need more resources, but a lot of times we just need to work more efficiently. And people mistake working efficiently for logic models and accountability and for long-term planning and blah, blah, blah. They mistake that. Accountability is the communication that happens between people, and we make it real. I see governments making that mistake quite often. They want tax dollars to be accountable, but accountability is in communication. It's in actually doing the work. It's not in tracking and logic models and all those other things. You may need some of that. And again, you may need some of it. It's a balance, but it doesn't take the place of really good communication. We meet once a month. We have our state there, we have our county there, and we have our citizens there. And we say, how is this strategy doing? Is it working? Oh, no, it's not working. Oh, crap. Well, reallocate resources in, because it's a crime to keep going in that one direction if it's not working. Or if it is working, how do we make it even work better?
And that's your logic model.
Exactly. That's the logic model. It's not something that someone made up in Washington, D.C. If we all agree that down deep inside of us, we all want the same things. I've been through a million different visioning and planning pieces, and I haven't really been to anyone that someone was really divergent and said, I don't want kids to grow up healthy. I mean, we can all probably, any one of us, say exactly what we want. We want healthy food for our children. We want good education. We want opportunities. I mean, we all can say that. I mean, I don't think there's anyone out there that can't. And so if we all want that, what stops us from getting there? And what stops us from getting there is that for some reason, and I don't think it's just in rural Nevada, I think it's everywhere, we have a fear that we do not have enough. And we just have to stop and think about that for a while. We have plenty. It's all about sharing. We have plenty of food in this country. There is absolutely no reason someone has to go hungry. And so why do we need 500 forms for someone to fill out in order to get a can of beans? And we have all these strange little processes that really instill fear and shame. One is that if you, I'm just going to pick food for right now. If you have food and we have plenty of canned food to share, and we're not talking filet mignon, we're talking rice, beans, the basics. And we have plenty to share. Why do we have to make it so difficult for people to get it? When we make it difficult, what we're saying to them is you don't really deserve this. Do you know how difficult that is for someone to hear that in a country that has plenty for everyone to eat, in a country that throws things away, to hear you're not really worthy enough for food? It's terrible. And it's shameful. And it's fearful. And it locks people in that shame and fear. And it makes them not want to talk about it. And it halts people in their process. It also halts people on the helping side because they don't really want to do it either. Food banks really don't want to spend their time logging people in, checking to make sure that they've got the proper documents and blah, blah, blah. They don't really want it. Nobody really wants to do this in the first place. And yet we spend so much time. And so that's the fear and shame of it. If we can step back and we can say, you know what, and which we did in this community, and I'm sure they've done it in plenty of other communities, every single person here is worthy of eating, period. Period. End of story. If you want to roll up in a Cadillac and say that for that day you need rice or beans, we don't know what your story is, but that is one way we can show you the love. And the other piece is what we've really tried to look at, and this is kind of like the agency level too, is that everyone has a feeling when they can help someone. That feeling is really good. It's empowering. So when you are giving out food and you're giving it in a loving way, what you get back is probably more powerful than that person getting the food. And so we want to share that feeling, not only with food, but for anything. If we can get people that have been struggling and are stuck in their journey for whatever reason, be it mental illness, be it an accident, be it addiction, whatever is stopping them in their journey, if we can get them that little win that they are feeling a part, they are included in that community, and they have that feeling, that moment, that empowerment. I just helped someone. That's what the feeling we want to share. We as social workers, as community change people, as, you know, people that want to do good, should not hoard that. I have a very small staff, but I said, you know, we get the blessing of being paid to do this work, but allow other people to feel what it feels like to help somebody, to truly help someone. We can clean the bathrooms, we can create logic models, we can deal with the bureaucracy vines. And so that's that love piece, and that's that acceptance. And once someone has that, if I can get one person, even if they are currently in their addiction, and we say, okay, so you can't be high currently when you volunteer, you're on your road to sobriety. When you're sober, come here. And if we can get them that win, they want to come back for it again and again and again.
Can you share a story of that, Christy?
Yeah. We had a young person, and this person was a parent. And they struggled with methamphetamine addiction. It was something that they tried when they were 12. It was an ongoing family thing. Unfortunately, they had 3 children, and they still had their methamphetamine addiction, and they really, really wanted to stop, but they could not. And I really can't imagine anything more painful than having the answer of what's killing you, and yet you can't unlock that door. I can't imagine that pain. And so we told this person, hey, we know you want to be sober. Why don't you come in and just help us? If you're getting some food, why don't you come in and help us distribute? So this person did. They came in and they helped. Long story short, they began a relationship with the people there and started to share their story. And so the period of times, the sobriety became longer and longer. Still not completely sober now, but, and I know this sounds like a strange win, but there was a relationship made, and these two women were talking, and one of her greatest fear was that she would bring another child into the situation. Her children are in protective custody right now. And so that person right then and there put her in the car, went down to the community health nurse, and got her a Norplant. And I know that seems like a weird win, but again, one less child is going to come into that chaotic, and that fear is lifted from her. There's that relationship piece. She knows that she's starting to problem solve on her own. Her period of sobrieties are getting longer. We would love to see her be sober and to welcome her children back in her life. That's what she wants more than anything, but we know she has to make the journey herself. Telling her, stay sober, really is not going to be helpful.
Right.
But to kind of love her where she's at. She is more than welcome to volunteer with us as long as she's sober at the time. Just to love her where she's at, we can already see some of that shame and some of that guilt lifting. When she comes back and she says, oh my God, I fell off the wagon again. There's people right there saying, it's okay. You know what? You're going to do it longer next time, and you're going to be able to kick this thing. This thing is kicking your ass, but it's good. You're going to be able to. And then there's that team, and suddenly she has a cheering section, something she has never experienced before. This person has never experienced what it feels like to give to someone. She's always taken. And so now she's giving, and she's healing because of it. She's creating a garden. She's doing all these things. It's so awesome. And that's just one example. If you make that change in your community where there's open spaces where people can be met where they're at and just loved on where they're at, and so they can make that next step for themselves into the journey they need to make to become all they can be. The last thing I want to say about acceptance and love, we talk a lot about it as a group, sameness and uniqueness. So we're all the same. We all want the same things, but we are all very unique. And we have to look at each other for those uniqueness. Not everyone, even though we want all the same things, we all don't have to play the same role. Yet all the roles are equally important. And I really want to stress this. The lawyer that comes in and volunteers his time is just as important as the person with who struggles with different disabilities who comes in and cleans the bathroom. I used to not let any of the volunteers clean the bathroom until this volunteer said, but that's my gift. That is my gift that I give to this community. And I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. So yes, we are the same about what we want, but we are unique in what we can do. And in that uniqueness, it's all beautiful. That lawyer volunteering his time is just as beautiful as that young man that comes on his bicycle to clean our bathroom. And his gift is just as important. Mm-hmm. We really need the bathrooms clean. We also really need to make sure we're not going to go to jail. It's valuing people and their contribution for what it is and allowing that person can bloom in their own beauty. And the last example I want to give to this is one of my greatest mentors was a young man that came into my life 2 years ago, and he was homeless. He never finished school and he couldn't read and all this kind of stuff. But he has the amazing ability to love everyone and all things equally. And the look on his face when he sees people and welcomes them into our coalition, he has trouble living on his own because he has some disabilities that doesn't allow him to be self-sustaining. And so many times we think, oh, our goal is to get everyone self-sustaining. Well, why? There's some people that that's not ever going to happen for them. But I can't imagine our coalition without this key leader, because he has taught us to love and he models it so well. I mean, he's one of the most powerful people that we have. And I couldn't imagine some of the work that we're doing now without this amazing young man. And so, again, the uniqueness of everyone, we do not have to be all the same. We do not have to reach the same plateau to be valued. Everyone has a place in community development.
Christy, your stories, every time I hear them, they blow me away. And you have done so probably a dozen times in the short time we've been talking now. Thank you so much for sharing your observations with our listeners today. Quite a lot to think about. Thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to Christy, two thoughts jump out. The first is the reminder that acceptance and love go a long way in building strength in all of us, and especially in people who are feeling less than strong. The second thought, though, is that we savvy Westerners feel almost embarrassed to say the words acceptance and love out loud in a business setting, and even more embarrassed to imagine using those forces as the basis of a systematic strategy. But as Christy notes, all the programs for inclusion and participation in the world are worthless if they're built upon fear and shame and decisions about who is deserving and who is not. We can see the power of acceptance and love in our own lives all the time. We see that acceptance and love do not equal weakness. The story Christy told of the woman struggling with addiction is just one case in point. We can be strong in saying, you will have all the love and support you need, but you can only be here when you're sober. There's nothing weak in that statement. It's a statement of power backed by acceptance and love. The results seem to abound in the stories Christy tells, the community that rose to support each other when the sheriff asked for their help with suicide prevention, the school district that opened its kitchen to local food producers, and the simple act of reaching out to government workers to give them a path beyond the frustration that almost defines what it is to work within a bureaucracy. Yes, planning is a major key to success, as Christy noted. But a plan rooted in fear and suspicion can only produce more fear and suspicion, while a plan rooted in love and inclusion will build just that, which leads to questions for your own work. First, are the systems in your workplace built upon acceptance and inclusion and sharing? Or are those systems built upon fear and scarcity, a sense that there's only so much to go around, and that we must therefore make choices about who deserves to be treated well? In the spectrum between those two ends, fear and exclusion versus acceptance and love and inclusion, where does your workplace lie? Second, what would it make possible if your employees and volunteers, your board members and community partners could always count on you to look for the best in them? What would meetings look like if your workplace was the most humane place in all the world to work? What would the typical workday look like? And what could you accomplish if that were so? And lastly, what would your programs look like if they were rooted in the assumption that everyone deserves to be treated with acceptance and love? How might your intake systems be different if they honored the journey of the person asking for help, looking for their strengths, and reflecting those strengths back to them? How might your fundraising systems be different if you loved and accepted your donors as people, loving them whether they give money or not? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast,
folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hilde Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and for our world. For Creating the Future and the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you next month here on Making Change.